I'm Desmond Brown, together with Justin Rushbrook, the joint head of 5RB Chambers. We hope that this podcast will assist with both specialist practitioners and those who are interested but not specialists dealing with media law day to day with an update on an important decision so far as the way in which the courts deal with weak claims at an interlocutory stage. With me to discuss the judgment in the Lachaud case, which came out in the middle of last month, the 12th of September, are Adrian Page QC, who appeared for the successful claimants with Godwin Basuthil.
I'm Adrian Page, Queen's Counsel. I've been in practice specialising in defamation for some 42 years now. Been a close colleague of Desmond Brown during that time. My interest in the Lachaud case is that I was counsel for the claimant, both in front of Mr. Justice Warby and in the Court of Appeal.
Gervase de Wilde, a junior member of Chambers.
I'm Gervase de Wilde. I've been in practice here for 4 years. Before that, I worked as a journalist at a national newspaper, so I've seen media law issues from both sides of the fence.
And Tom Blackburn.
I'm Tom Blackburn, SC. I've been at the Sydney Bar since 1988 and in Silicon Australia since 2003. My practice has been in defamation and media law in that time.
The Lachaud case has been the subject of a great deal of comment and criticism, a lot of it partisan. And so the first thing I wanted to do was to ask Adrian a very general question before we delve into the detail of the decision as to whether it was right to treat it as the Law Society Gazette did, as dealing a blow to hopes that the 2013 Defamation Act would raise the bar to libel actions in England and Wales, raising the bar being what the explanatory notes to the Act say about Section 1.1. Adrian.
I disagree with that analysis by the Law Society Gazette, and I think this is a classic case where we will have a much clearer idea as the new jurisprudence is applied and the judges work it out in practice. The sort of situation where I think that the bar will have been raised will be, for instance, in that very common situation we have in defamation where a claimant pleads that the defamatory meaning imputes that they were guilty of some misconduct, and the defendants seek to say that the actual meaning of the words to be decided by the judge is something lesser, such as grounds to investigate. And I think that is the area where there will be real measurable difference to practice, where judges will rule out those lower meanings which were treated as defamatory before and will no longer be treated as defamatory following Section 1.1 and Lachaud.
Lord Justice Davis talked about the conceptual impenetrability of Section 1. What did he mean when he said that the section had effectually given statutory status to Thornton?
In terms of the conceptual impenetrability, I think the problem is the wording of has caused marks a slight difference to the approach of Mr. Justice Tugendhat in Thornton, where the traditional common law approach of treating the defamatory or the harmful tendency of words that are published being the test for defamatory at common law was endorsed, but with a higher threshold of the threshold of seriousness, namely substantiality, something that substantially adversely affects the attitude of people towards the claimant. I think that what Lord Justice Davis recognised was that the Parliament had not flagged up and had not purported to abolish the large swathes of the common law that would be entailed if Section 1.1 was intended not simply to build on Thornton, as explanatory notes said, but actually to dismantle that approach of Mr. Justice Tugendhat in Thornton and do something completely different, namely requiring actual proof of damage as an ingredient of the cause of action. So I think that as far as the Court of Appeal were concerned, they were looking to see what you could infer about what Parliament intended in terms of the common law as it stands, to what extent was the common law being abolished, and once you conclude that the common law was not being abolished in all the various respects which flowed from Mr. Justice Warby's judgment, then you had to come back really to Thornton plus.
Now, Mr. Justice Warby reached the right decision, but along the way, the steps that he took were subject to criticism by the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal were very struck by your phrase that Mr. Justice Warby had not so much raised the bar as erected another hurdle. What was that hurdle you were referring to?
Well, the test for actionability as defamatory at common law was always a one-stage objective process, which after Thornton was simply to ask the question whether the publication was one which substantially affected in an adverse manner the attitude of people towards the claimant or had a tendency so to do. That hurdle, post Lachaud at first instance, still had to be got over by a claimant. But even once got over, that didn't establish actionability. At that point, a second hurdle, identified by Mr. Justice Warby from Section 1.1, had also to be surmounted. And as Mr. Justice Warby expressed it in paragraph 45 of his own judgment, it was whether the claimant had proved on the balance of probabilities that serious reputational harm has been caused or is likely to result from the publication complained of. So that was the second hurdle, and that is the hurdle that the Court of Appeal said was not erected afresh or anew by Section 1.1.
And as all practitioners know, it's often extremely difficult, if not impossible, for claimants to provide positive evidence of harm to reputation. Is that what Lord Justice Davis had in mind when he distinguished between reputational harm and the consequences of harm?
Absolutely. Reputational harm has always been what the common law has recognised as what takes place when words that pass the test of defamatory, whatever that test is at whatever time, are published to a third person. And one will remember that in the case of Cheval Press Alliance, the question was, where did the harmful event take place? And the harmful event there was publication. Now, that harm to reputation is one thing. The damage that flows from the harm is a different thing. And Lord Justice Davis was emphasising the importance of distinguishing between what may be the consequence of the harm, which is the consequential damage, and the actual harm, which is the publication itself.
Now, there were a number of points that troubled the Court of Appeal about Mr. Justice Warby's construction of Section 1.1. Lord Justice Davis said he was particularly troubled by Mr. Justice Warby's construction of Section 1, leading to the statement that the legal presumption of damage no longer had a significant role to play. What is the role now, after Lachaud and the Court of Appeal, of the presumption of damage?
The common law presumption of damage, prior to the decision of Mr. Justice Warby, operated really to the following effect. If the court finds that publication took place of words that are defamatory, that is to say, inherently harmful to reputation to the required standard, the law presumes that some damage at least to reputation has been caused. So in order to succeed on liability hitherto, a claimant has not had to bring forward actual proof of damage to his reputation. However, his failure to do so at trial, and that whether by actual direct evidence or by inference, for example, from the seriousness of the imputations, the number of publishees, could result in an award of only nominal damages. And as Lord Justice Davis pointed out at 58 of his judgment, the presumption of damage had always been a concomitant of the tort in cases of libel, and as Mr. Justice Tugendhat had pointed out in Thornton, its existence was compatible with a raised threshold test for what level of imputation will qualify as defamatory. And the position now settled by the Court of Appeal, see, for example, Lord Justice Davis at paragraph 70, is that if the meaning determined by the court conveys a serious defamatory imputation, then an inference of serious reputational harm ordinarily can and should be drawn accordingly. And at that point, the presumption of harm will kick in and the matter will ordinarily proceed onwards to trial.
The words "should be drawn" are a pretty strong hint, aren't they?
Very strong, yes.
Now, Lord Justice Davis said he thought that there had been conflation between a presumption and an inference. I found that fairly esoteric, but there is a significant difference between the two, isn't there?
Yes. The presumption kicks in by operation of law. An inference is about proving a fact. In the case of inference, what the Court of Appeal is saying is that if it's a serious defamatory imputation, then one can infer serious reputational harm. I mean, that is essentially a finding of fact or a conclusion of fact. And then at that point is when the legal presumption said in by the Court of Appeal in the Jameel and Dow Jones case to be an irrebuttable presumption, at that point the legal presumption of harm applies, and that is what then completes the cause of action.
Well, just on the completion of the cause of action, an important part of the Court of Appeal judgment related to the date when the cause of action accrues. And on that, they differed both from Mr. Justice Warby and with Mr. Justice Bean in the case of Cook. What was that decision on the date of accrual of the cause of action?
Well, they decided that the traditional common law still applied and wasn't abolished by Section 1.1, namely that the cause of action arises upon and no later than the publication to a third party of defamatory words. The difficulty that Mr. Justice Bean got into is that he expressed the incorrect view in his judgment in Cook and MGN that at the moment of publication, no harm to reputation is caused. And that was his failure to distinguish between harm to reputation and consequential damage. And that unfortunately led to the misconceived and unresolved conundrum that was passed from judge to judge in a number of cases since Cook and MGN as to whether the existence or otherwise of serious harm was to be judged as at the date of the claim form or as at the date of the determination. Well, that was wrong in either case. According to the Court of Appeal, the determination of serious harm is to be judged as at the date of publication.
So publications can no longer drift in and out of actionability?
No, we can't have a situation where at one moment it may be defamatory and then perhaps a very fulsome, widely circulated apology is published and it ceases to be defamatory, or conversely, it's considered to be not defamatory and then somebody gets a brick through their window and they can point to some identifiable consequential damage and it then becomes defamatory. That would obviously be unworkable in practice, and the idea that you can have an inchoate cause of action lying in wait for a piece of damage or some evidence of a likelihood of damage, that is no longer open to argument.
And it also simplifies the law of limitation in this respect.
And it absolutely simplifies the law of limitation. It was canvassed in the Court of Appeal by Evening Standard and independent defendants, not by AOL, that nobody need worry about the fact that the cause of action might accrue only some time after publication, notwithstanding that there is a 1-year limitation period for defamation. It was pointed out that under the Limitation Act, the court has a discretion to disapply the limitation period, and it was suggested that you just go along to court and ask to disapply when you are in a position sometime post-publication, perhaps over a year after publication, to point to some consequential damage.
Mr. Justice Warby took the view that the necessary construction of Section 1.1 not only meant that the legal presumption of damage was no longer significant, but that the so-called Jamil jurisdiction had been wholly subsumed by the reformed law. Can you just remind our listeners what exactly is the Jamil jurisdiction?
The Jamil jurisdiction arises from the decision of the Court of Appeal in Jamil and Dow Jones. They were invited to conclude that the presumption of damage was contrary to Article 10 and should no longer be recognised as part of the law of defamation in this country. The Court of Appeal rejected that, but they recognised that there would be cases, of which the case before them was one, where in actual practice, no or minimal harm had been done to reputation. And in that case, it was a very small publication. Once Dow Jones had investigated how many subscribers there were in the jurisdiction, I think it was down to about five, three of whom were part of the claimant's camp anyway, and two of whom had never heard of the claimant. They were able to get that evidence. And what the Court of Appeal decided was not to get rid of the presumption of damage and throw the baby out with the bathwater, but to say that in circumstances where the continuation of an action, which of course has a technically good constitution in terms of its course of action, but where the continuation of the action was not serving the legitimate purpose of vindication or as a ground for an injunction against a future publication of the allegation, then the court could stop the proceedings as, in effect, an abusive process. And that's become known as Jamil abusive process. It is an exceptional jurisdiction. But rather than that being subsumed within Section 1.1, as Mr. Justice Warby concluded, the Court of Appeal says that is still a freestanding, separate means of dealing with cases that are brought that may be described as trivial in terms of the likely harm to the reputation.
So in the context of Section 1.1 cases, would Jamil only be operative in a case where there was a cause of action, in other words, where Section 1.1 had been prima facie satisfied?
Yes, that would certainly be my view, that Jamil is about treating as an abuse a good cause of action, a technically good cause of action, and stopping it for reasons unrelated to whether or not there is a good cause of action.
Gervais, I want to turn to you now and deal with the question of how in the future defendants should deal with weak claims. Lord Justice Davis was conscious that there was a potential degree of overlap between the Jamil jurisdiction and both an application for summary judgment and the issues that would arise at a hearing of a preliminary issue on serious harm. In future, which of the three options I've mentioned are going to be most help to defendants, or are they going to fire all three barrels?
The judgment has the important conceptual ramifications for the law of defamation, which Adrienne has described, but in many ways one of its primary focuses is on procedure. Obviously, it's very critical of the procedure adopted in the Lachaud litigation and indicates that the kind of complex and costly pretrial hearings which took place there to resolve major contested issues relating to Section 1.1 are now to be avoided. However, the judgment expressly declares that it is not one which would leave defendants at the mercy of trivial claims, and there is still scope following the judgment to explore whether a claim does get over the Section 1.1 threshold. It suggests that there are three potential avenues that defendants could explore in that regard. One of those is by way of a Jamil application. The other is by making an application for summary judgment in relation to the Section 1.1 threshold issue. And the third is for serious harm to be assessed at the trial of meaning as a preliminary issue. To answer your question, it seems to me that following the judgment, the indications that it gives in relation to summary judgment are not necessarily ones that should be adopted exclusively by those trying to deal with weak claims on a Section 1-1 basis, and that there is still plenty of scope for the Jamil jurisdiction to be exercised by defendants. The judgment does refer explicitly to the possibility of a Part 24 summary judgment application, and in doing so it seems to be in many ways a rejection of the kind of exceptionalism that often springs up in this area of the law. However, it seems that that would be a very high threshold for a defendant to cross, since that would be an application brought on the basis that the claimant had no real prospect of establishing a cause of action at all. Whereas, by contrast, the Jamil jurisdiction that Adrienne has just described, it is more flexible. It's a less stringent test, which takes into consideration Article 10 factors and allows for a proportionality exercise to be carried out, which would potentially result in the court finding that although there was a good cause of action established, it's not one that's worth pursuing through the litigation. So although the judgment, it says two different things about Jamil, it says that the Jamil jurisdiction is still available. It also suggests that it will be rarely used. But in my view, it's the first of those points which is important, that it is still available to defendants and still potentially has an important role to play in this type of litigation.
If Section 1-1 was satisfied because the words were so defamatory as to give rise to the inference of serious harm, would it ever be possible to use the Part 24 summary judgment procedure?
It doesn't seem likely that it would be on purely a Section 1-1 basis. Obviously, the summary judgment procedure is used in relation to other discrete issues within libel litigation. For example, an unanswerable defence of qualified privilege and no case on malice. But it's hard to see that once the hurdle has been got over, that Part 24 would have a role to play after that point.
So that's where the defendant reaches for Jamil.
Yes, so then the defendant could reach for Jamil, or alternatively they could at an earlier stage, at the determination of meaning as a preliminary issue, argue that the meaning which has been pleaded is not itself serious enough to get over the Section 1-1 threshold, or that the court should find an alternative meaning, a defendant's meaning, which is itself not serious enough to get over it.
Adrian, just remind me, how much evidence was there before Mr. Justice Warby and Lachaud?
There was evidence on both sides, as between the claimant and AOL. The claimant was required for cross-examination, so he was cross-examined on his witness statement. The AOL defendants put in evidence from his former wife, Afsana Lachaud, and we said that we wouldn't cross-examine her. The evidence of the claimant went on for some hours. The cross-examination of the claimant went on for some hours. There was then an attempt, since he was required to produce a few more documents overnight, to further cross-examine him on day two, which we were able to resist. It was then subsequently submitted that because we hadn't cross-examined Afsana Lachaud, that we were bound by her evidence. And if we had cross-examined her, then instead of a two-day hearing, I think we would have probably had a three-day hearing.
And documents, the volume of documents?
And the volume of documents, not huge, no. It was, the documents are mainly things to show his the extent of his reputation in this country. It wasn't a vast amount. It was really the kind of painstaking cross-examination of him in relation to, you know, who do you know here, and, you know, how do you know they read it? It was very, very into minutiae.
Those sort of questions, Gervais, sound like a thing of the past now.
Yes, I think they probably are, certainly at the preliminary issue stage. If they were ever to be relevant, that it's conceivable that they could be relevant to damages at trial.
And are the costs of the exercise known, Adrian?
I don't know what the total cost of the proceedings in front of Mr. Justice Warby were on the preliminary issue. What we do know is that before the 2 days preliminary issue, AOL announced, and it was referred to in court, that their anticipated costs of that hearing would be £220,000. Now, of course, it may be that in the end they were less or they were more, but substantial costs were incurred all round. In the case of in The Independent and Evening Standard, their counsel, Mr. David Price, QC, announced that he was capping his costs, his solicitor advocate, at £50,000. So you've already got £270,000 being anticipated even before you have the claimant's costs. And as I pointed out, if AOL had had their way, there would have been more cross-examination of the claimant than there already was, and there would have been cross-examination of Afsana Lashow. And indeed, we ended at the end of the 2 days with AOL applying for the parties to put in further written submissions, and I'm glad to say that the judge saw that off as well.
Gervais, the decision of Mr. Justice Beenie Cook attached great importance to the publication of an apology, which in his view wiped out the possibility of serious reputational harm. Where does that stand now? I mean, is an apology going to help when arguing about Section 1-1?
It doesn't seem, in light of what the Court of Appeal said in the show, that an apology would now have any real role to play in relation to Section 1-1. The difference between a cause of action being extinguished by an apology and the damages being reduced to nothing might be rather an abstract one. But the application of this principle of a cause of action arising precisely at the time of publication means that neither an apology nor a denial by the claimant would strictly be relevant to Section 1-1 anymore.
Tom, can I turn to you now? As a recent recruit to this jurisdiction, how do all these arguments, and indeed how does the legislation strike you?
It's very interesting to me because when you look at the impetus, or what seems to me to be the impetus for Section 1-1, it depends on a number of factors which just don't apply in Australia. I mean, if one of the origins of Section 1-1 was Thornton, Thornton seems very much to have depended upon the requirements of the Convention and in particular Article 10. And Article 10, amongst and perhaps also the needs of proportionality, required that there be a kind of substantial harm threshold introduced into the law of defamation, and that seems to have kick-started Section 1-1 of the 2013 Act. We don't have, of course, the convention in Australia, and proportionality, although important in the rules, doesn't seem to assume quite the central importance in case management as it does here. So we have our own rather more traditional and more permissive regime for weeding out insignificant claims. It's found in the Uniform Australian Defamation Law at Section 33 in the New South Wales version. It's in these terms: it's a defence to the publication of defamatory matter if the defendant proves that the circumstances of publication were such that the plaintiff was unlikely to sustain any harm.
And does that apply in all states?
It does. It does.
So it would have applied in Victoria in the Rebel Wilson case?
Yes, yes.
Could you tell us about that?
Certainly. The Rebel Wilson case has got a lot of publicity lately. The trial judge in Australia hands out the damages even if there's a jury. The jury decides all the factual issues. And the trial judge handed out $4.5 million, about £2.7 million, which was obviously partly general damage and partly special damages. Which is, by the way, that the quantum is on appeal at the moment. One of the defences was this defence of triviality, as it's called. The plaintiff tried to have it taken from the jury, really on the basis that the imputations were so serious that the defence couldn't possibly succeed and that any jury verdict would be perverse based on that defence. The imputations were serial lying and inventing fantastic stories about, dramatic stories about her background and so on. The defendant, in response to that application to take the issue from the jury, said, well, there is evidence that is either admitted or uncontested that suggests that readers of a supermarket magazine like The Woman's Day would know or be likely to know that actors routinely embellish matters about their background in order to market themselves and cultivate a particular interesting personality. And on that basis, the readers of The Woman's Day, when they read these things, would only see harmless white lies. The trial judge acknowledged that there was some evidence of that kind on which conceivably a jury could find that no harm had been sustained, and allowed the issue, rather reluctantly, I think, in his judgment, to go to the jury. Of course, the defence failed. It's a very high bar and a very high onus for a defendant to get over. My experience with this section and its very similar predecessor in the infrequent cases where I've been for a defendant and pleaded it is that I've never really had a strong expectation that it would succeed. And given the high onus, I mean, in media cases, I'm not really aware of any media case where it has succeeded.
Has there been pressure in Australia for a reform akin to something like the 2013 Act?
No, none at all. And in fact, I can round this off really by saying that Jameel, well, it's not exactly the same parallel, but Jameel has received a rather cool reception in Australia. It's been followed in a couple of first instance cases, but at the appellate level, it's either been disapproved or spoken of with disapproval or spoken of coolly. For example, one case, the Court of Appeal said, well, this needs to be considered in the proper case, and the difference between the legislative provisions, the fact that there is no Human Rights Act or convention in Australia, all these things need to be considered in order to determine whether Jameel is actually good law in Australia. So there is really no pressure for, I don't think, something like Section 1.1.
Well, a final question to you, Adrian. Has Section 1.1 turned out to be a mouse?
No, of course it hasn't. It's raised the bar, and that is what Parliament was asked to do, that is what Parliament intended to do, and that is what Parliament has done. And if the judges who apply Section 1.1 aren't using it to exclude trivial allegations, then no doubt the Court of Appeal will put that right.
I've been in practice now for over 40 years and in Silk for some 25 years. And during all of that time, I've been doing media work. So I've seen a lot of changes. And the 2013 Act and the way in which it's been interpreted by the courts is perhaps the most important in my professional lifetime. Well, thank you all very much for listening to this podcast. If you want further details about this or any aspect of media law, do look at our 5RB website.